The title of the message this morning is True Faith Produces Wise Behavior. I hope all of you have it. I hope all of you have wise behavior, because it is an evidence that you really do have faith. The previous section here in James was addressed specifically to teachers, you might remember, teachers in the church, with a secondary application to all believers. Look at James 3:1. It said there, "My brethren, be not many teachers." And the principal instruction last week was that true teachers are able to bridle their tongues. That's a evidence of a true teacher. They are able to open their mouths without sinning. This, of course, also applies to all Christians. It's the way we all should be. And a very good sign of true faith is the ability to control the tongue. Now, in our text for this morning, it may be that James still has teachers primarily in mind, but the instruction again applies to all of us. And James will now tell us that the man with true faith produces wise behavior. When a man stands up to teach in the church, I suppose that we all think that he has a degree of knowledge in his subject. Perhaps he went to Bible school or to seminary. Perhaps he studied for many years in his office at home. He has acquired lots of books. And it must be that he has some knowledge, because he's standing up to teach in the church. And it is true that knowledge is a very good thing for a teacher to have. Look what James says in verse 13. James 3:13 says, "Who is a wise man and endued with what? Knowledge among you." You'll notice here, however, that more is required than mere knowledge. James is interested to discover whether a man has wisdom to go along with his knowledge. It's one thing to have intellectual accomplishment. Perhaps a man knows the Greek grammar, and he thinks that qualifies him as an outstanding Christian or an outstanding teacher. He has mastered Old Testament history, and he can probably win a game of Bible trivia. But James is going to advise us that the mark of true faith is godly wisdom that is able to apply that knowledge. It says, "Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you?" Our text this morning is about godly wisdom. And in order to instruct on godly wisdom, James will contrast it with worldly wisdom. He calls godly wisdom the wisdom from above in verse 17. And he calls worldly wisdom the wisdom that descendeth not from above. So we want to take a look first at the proof of the man who has wisdom from above. What do we look for in this kind of man? This is in verse 13. We have two men here, and both claim to have wisdom, apparently, and perhaps they are both applying for the teaching position in the church. And when we interview them, they both have wonderful intellectual credentials. They graduated from the best schools. They are accomplished in the Greek and Hebrew languages, and they can win in Bible trivia. But then we ask them if they are wise men, because we have read James 3:1, and we understand that a man should have both knowledge and wisdom. Wisdom, as you probably know, is the skill to apply divine truth. And so we want to know if these two men have the wisdom required, not only to know the truth, but to apply it in their own lives. And they both say they have it. But James is going to tell us how to tell if they have it. You might have noticed that James is not big on just believing what a man says, is he? If a man says that he has faith, we saw this a couple of weeks ago, if a man says he has faith, James wants to see the works to prove it. James is very practical-minded, as you've seen. He wants to see the proof. And if a man says he has wisdom, James wants to see the proof. Look at verse 13 again. It says, let him show. Let him show it. If a man says he is wise, let him show it. Let me take a good look at his life, and I will then tell you whether he has wisdom. Like faith, wisdom is an intangible thing. You can't look at a man and see it from the externals. You can't necessarily believe it if he says that he has it, but you can see tangible evidence of it. Now, James is sort of an interactive teacher. He likes to ask questions as a lead-in to his instruction, and he begins by asking the question, who is a wise man endued with knowledge among you? And perhaps he is asking for a show of hands, you see. I might ask that question here. Who is it that has wisdom? We'd probably all be reluctant, wouldn't we, to raise our hands. And when James's letter is read aloud in the churches, some might raise their hands, and maybe some would not be quite so sure. And they would scratch their heads and say, but we don't really know. And James, why don't you tell us what to look for? How do we know who has wisdom to go along with their knowledge? And now James is going to tell the church what to look for in a wise man. But I want you to notice first the source of this wisdom. This is found in verse 15 of our text. It appears that godly wisdom descends out of heaven. It is wisdom from above as opposed to wisdom from below. It is heavenly wisdom as opposed to earthly wisdom. It is a gift from God. God is, by the way, the sole possessor of wisdom, and only He can give it. I want you to flip back a page or two to James chapter 1 and verse 5, where it says, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. Well, that's a nice place to ask for it, isn't it? Because He owns it. Let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. I hope you have asked for wisdom. I hope you ask for wisdom often because it is divinely given. So divine wisdom is a very special thing. It is a miraculous kind of wisdom. It is very remarkable. It exceeds earthly wisdom by far. And that is because it is from above. It is from God Himself. So if God has it and we want it, it makes sense that we should ask for it. Now, I took Sebastian, my little 7-year-old grandchild now, to Sonic the other day, and he said he wasn't too hungry. I said, you don't want anything? He said, no. And so I was hungry. I ordered me a bacon breakfast toaster. I love those things. And all he wanted was a drink. And when we had received our order, we headed home, and we were only a couple of blocks down the road when I unwrapped my bacon sandwich, and I was ready to take my first bite, and Sebastian smelled it, and he said, Pappy, can I have your sandwich? And I said, boy, I thought you weren't hungry. And he said, I am now. I said, do you want the whole sandwich and leave me with none at all? He said, yeah. I said, I'm not going to give you my whole sandwich, but I'll give you half of it. and I tore the sandwich in two and gave him half. I've noticed that Sebastian has no reservations about asking for anything I have. One day I was in the bathroom getting dressed and I had some money laying on the counter. I looked over and Sebastian was putting it in his pocket. When he saw me looking at him, he said, "Pappy, can I have your money?" And I said, "Yeah, you can have it." And God has spare wisdom just lying around in his house, you see. And you are his child. And if you ask for it, he's liable to say, "Yes, you can have it." It says in James 1:5 again, "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him." So we've seen that the source of wisdom is God, but now we're going to take a look at the nature of this wisdom. This is found in also in verse 13. First of all, we want to establish that godly wisdom is based on the foundation of knowledge. It says, "Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you?" Knowledge is not to be disparaged. It is the backbone of wisdom. It is hard to imagine wisdom without a good stock of knowledge. Wisdom is the proper application of knowledge. So knowledge is a necessary component of wisdom. We must increase our knowledge and then ask for wisdom to steer knowledge in the right direction. I encourage all Christians, and I encourage all of us everywhere, to strive to obtain much Bible knowledge. Knowledge is like having money in the bank when you need it. Two women went shopping. One woman was a very wise shopper, like my wife. She can find the best deals I've ever seen. She knew how to spend her money wisely, you see, but she only had $20. And she made the most of her money, but she still came home with just a little bit. The other woman was not very wise at all in her spending, but she had $1,000 in her purse. And despite her careless spending, she came home with a good deal more. And to apply wisdom, it is good to have a large bankroll of knowledge. Wisdom is the skill in the application of knowledge. And so don't shortchange yourself in the knowledge of God's Word. And James says, "Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge?" So we have seen that a truly wise man is a knowing man. He's a man with some knowledge. But then we see that a truly wise man has good behavior. This is found in verse 13 as well. How can we tell if he's a wise man? It says, "Who is a wise man and a dude with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation, good behavior, his works." It is interesting here that in God's accounting, there is a moral aspect to wisdom. I think you'll see that in our text. Wisdom is shown by good behavior. You can see a man's wisdom by the good and moral life that he lives. If he is wiser than others, then this will be shown by the goodness of his behavior. Now, perhaps we've never thought of wisdom in this way, but this seems to be what James is saying. No one is wise who is not good. And if you are a bad person, then you are not wise. You see how true wisdom has a moral component. If you watch a wise man, you will notice that he has very good behavior and he does good works. That's what James says. He says, "Who is a wise man and a dude with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works." I've noticed that James is very big on works, isn't he? He first told us that we don't have faith if we don't have works. And now he tells us that we don't have wisdom if we don't have works. Just as our faith must be proven, so our wisdom must be proven too by our works. And when you open your mouth, your wisdom should be evident to all. If words come out of your mouth that inform others and heal others and do good to others, then these are the marks of wisdom. But if your words do mischief, and if your words hurt others, and if they are occasions of evil, then this is a sign that you are not a wise man at all. But now we also see that a truly wise man may be known by his meekness. Do you see that in verse 13? The meekness of wisdom. It's just characteristic of true wisdom. We've already seen that true faith bridles the tongue, and now we find that true faith, which has wisdom, bridles anger too. Here is wisdom, you see. You bridle your own anger, and you patiently bear the anger of others, and you will be very meek and mild in your behavior. Meekness is a great friend to wisdom. Your unbridled passions will distort your apprehension of things. You won't see them right. It will distort your judgment of things, and you will not act wisely. But a wise man is meek and is best able to act and to speak wisely. Matthew Henry put it this way, quote, "Wisdom produces meekness, and meekness increases wisdom," unquote. So you see how wisdom and meekness go hand in hand, and they fuel each other. I want to comment briefly on meekness this morning. The world does not smile too much on meekness. The dictionary, if you go there and look up the word meekness, it will describe it in negative terms. Passive. And other such terms. The world admires the high and the mighty and the powerful. If you are loud and demanding, you may get your way in this world. But meekness is to be admired in God's kingdom. It was one of the chief personal qualities of Jesus, by the way. Jesus said, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am what? Meek. And lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls." By the way, meekness does not mean lack of strength. It doesn't mean that you're a weak person. Jesus was very strong. He created the universe with his word. He sustains the universe by his awesome power. Meekness does not mean passive resignation. Jesus didn't give up and give in to the Pharisees, but he challenged them. Sometimes he embarrassed them. Jesus was very authoritative in his speech, and the spies who went out to hear him reported that no man ever spake like this man, such authority he had. But here is what meekness is. It is strength under control. And more specifically, it is the deliberate acceptance of God's will. You see, you have an understanding that God has a will in things. God has a plan in things, and you're submissive to it. Jesus was very meek in his acceptance of his role in this world. He was very strong and could have annihilated all of his enemies. He could have resisted when they tried to take him, but he didn't resist. He did not fight against God's will. Rather, he humbly submitted to it. This attitude of meekness was reflected in the garden when he said, "Not my will, but thine be done." That's meekness. Meekness is gentleness under pressure. Most of us explode in anger and rage under pressure. And that is very unwise behavior. But the wise man is very gentle, resting under the sovereign will of God. We've seen the proof of the man who has wisdom from above. He has good behavior, he has good works, and he is very meek. But there's another kind of man. This is the man who doesn't have true faith and who doesn't care about God's wisdom at all. Oh, he thinks he's pretty smart, but he only operates according to the world's kind of wisdom. He is a bully. He gets what he wants by fighting and by bad behavior. So now James will show us the proof of the man who has wisdom from below. This is found, you'll notice, in verses 14 and 15. It says, "But if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not," in other words, don't be proud of it, "and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish." I want you to notice where the source of this wisdom in verse 15, it is from below. It does not descend from above, but it descends from below. God's wisdom is from above, that is his divine wisdom. It is wisdom according to God, and it is given by him, especially to those who want it and ask for it. But notice that there is a wisdom from below. Jesus calls it earthly, sensual, and devilish. And you have to watch out for this kind of wisdom because it is not really wisdom at all. Notice first of all that human wisdom is earthly. James says it's earthly. When James calls it earthly, I think he means to suggest that it comes from human sources rather than from God. Sometimes we call it human viewpoint. It is man's way of thinking. It is the creature figuring out things on his own apart from God. And you can almost always write it down as a universal principle. Man's way is the wrong way. It says in Isaiah chapter 55, verses 8 and 9, this is God speaking, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." The question is, are we willing to accept God's thoughts as true wisdom, or are we going to continue to behave according to the world's wisdom? Secondly, we notice that human wisdom is sensual, you'll notice. Earthly, sensual, devilish. Earthly wisdom is based on indulging the flesh. It is very selfish and carnal. It springs from the baser motives and is intent on serving the lusts of the flesh. The man with earthly wisdom is not too concerned about others, but he is very concerned about himself. He will trample on others in order to satisfy his own desires. And at the end of the destruction, he will think himself to have been very wise. Thirdly, human wisdom is devilish. It is the wisdom of devils. Devils think it very wise to work their evil. When they do great harm to others, they congratulate themselves and they say, "Look how smart and how wise we were. We brought him down, didn't we?" When they deceive men, they applaud their own wisdom. They think themselves very wise when they are full of hate and wrath. And therefore, whoever prefers the wisdom of devils falls into a devil's condemnation. But let's look further into this world's wisdom. And James tells us that it is evidenced by bitter envying and strife in the heart. This is found in verse 14. "But if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish." You may think, you probably do think, that you are very smart and very wise. However, if your heart is full of bitter envying and strife, you are not wise at all. If your heart is always in a turmoil, if you are bitter about everything, if everything in your life is a fight, then you are basing your life on worldly wisdom. Now you think you're very smart, but James says, don't glory. Don't think so highly of yourself. Don't think that you are better than everyone else. Your wisdom is earthly and sensual and devilish. On the other hand, if love and peace and meekness and gentleness are your way of behavior, then you are a wise person. The wise man prefers love, you see, to hate. He prefers peace to war. He prefers forgiveness to bitterness. You see, the wise man has a divine perspective and has a divine grip on his heart. And he sees past earthly wisdom and considers God's wisdom to be of much greater value. And as to the world's wisdom, it is evidenced by behavior that contradicts the truth. Look at verse 14. But if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. The bottom line is that this world's wisdom ultimately is contrary to the truth of God. And it will always show up in your behavior. Your behavior will, in the final analysis, be contrary to the Scriptures. The Scriptures say, love, peace, and joy. And your life is hate, war, and discontent. James calls it envying and strife. You can't help it, because your wisdom for life comes from below. It's all you've ever known. It's all you've ever heard. And if this is the wisdom that you build your life upon, then look what you can expect. He says, for where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. We want to take a look at a further description now of true wisdom. James gave us a little bit about that to begin his sermon. Then he told us about what earthly wisdom is like, and now he's going to further describe true wisdom. This is found in verses 17 and 18. It says in verse 17 and 18, but the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated or instructed, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy, and the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. Does that describe you? I hope it does. It is good to take note once again that true wisdom is a gift. It is wisdom from above. It is a very great gift, and you will not find it anywhere else. It is only found in the reservoir of God's attributes, and you will only have it if the fountain of wisdom is opened up to you. And God will be pleased to open it up to you if you ask for it. Wouldn't it be great to have the wisdom of God at work in your life, you see? Here are some of the characteristics of God's wisdom, and wouldn't it be nice to have these things in your life? First of all, God's wisdom is pure. Do you see that in verse 17? It is pure. You know, when you receive the wisdom of God, you know that you are getting the real thing. There is no mixture of human viewpoint. It is all God's way of thinking. That's what I love about God's truth. That's what I love about the Scriptures. It is absolute truth. There is no error in it. There is no fault in it. There is nothing in it that will lead you astray. It will bring great benefit to you, and it will not lead you into bad behavior in your life. God's wisdom will not lead you into sin, but it will lead you into wholesomeness and righteousness. And what a wonderful life that is. Secondly, not only is it pure, it is peaceable. Peaceable. In verse 17, these are the characteristics of God's wisdom. These are what God's wisdom will produce in your life. And we see that God's wisdom will show up as peaceableness in your life. The lost man is not a peaceful man. He is at war. He is very angry. He is very rarely happy. And life around this man is not pleasant at all. Everything is contentious. It must be his way, and there is no peace in his household. Those who are truly wise will do what they can to preserve peace. They do what they can to make peace when peace has been broken. Peace is of great value to the wise man, and he does what he can to have it. It is a very great thing to have peace in your country. We've been blessed in our country. We've had many days of peace. War will bring devastation and great loss. Even the victors in war are often losers in the end. War is waged at a very great cost. It is also a very great thing to have peace in your families. It is God's design for families, by the way. Christian families are peaceful families. Families with true faith are peaceful families, and peace at home is a very great blessing to everyone in the family. Did you know that children are blessed when they are born into peaceful families? But woe to the children of warring families. It is imperative that churches be peaceful churches. What a contradiction when there is a warring church. How can this possibly be? How can there be bitterness and envy and war in a church? When you find such a thing, you have found a place where the Spirit of the Lord is not present. When there are unregenerate people in the church, you will have great problems. And when there is earthly, sensual, and devilish wisdom in the church, then there will be no peace at all. But then we find, as to God's wisdom, that it is gentle in verse 17. Here's how it will show up in your life. It will show up in gentleness. A man full of God's wisdom is not rough and harsh and hard to get along. But a man full of God's wisdom is very gentle. You will trust him with your little infant child. Now, he may be very strong, but he's very gentle. And we are not just talking about physical gentleness, but we're talking about a gentle spirit. Children may be drawn to him because he's no threat to them at all. He's very gentle. He's very safe. He is tender and kind. This is what God's wisdom produces in the godly man. Nextly, we see in verse 17 that he is easy to be entreated. What this means is that you can talk to the wise man. He is amenable to change if he is at fault. He will listen to wise counsel. He is very prone to follow after that which is good, and he is quick to forsake that which is evil. Of course, the opposite is true of the world's wisdom. The world's wisdom says, never admit that you're wrong. Hold your ground no matter what. Always be on the attack and never bend. But God's wisdom says, be easy to entreat. Be easy to be entreated. We see in verse 17 also, as to true wisdom, that it is full of mercy. The man with God's wisdom is full of mercy. He looks for opportunities to be merciful. We were driving down the road. I was visiting my brother a few weeks back. We're driving down the road. He had a four-wheel drive. He came across someone that had lost their way down in the ditch. I noticed he pulled over. I pulled in behind him, wondering what he was doing. He was going to help the lady out of the ditch, you see. And that's the way we should be, full of mercy. The wise man looks for opportunities to be merciful. His heart is disposed to do everything that is kind and good. He seeks to relieve all those who are in distress. He's quick to forgive those who offend. But next we see in verse 17 that true wisdom is full of good fruits. Do you see that? Full of good fruits. The man with God's wisdom seems always to be producing good works and good things in his life. He is noteworthy for his good deeds. His neighbors are glad to have him for a neighbor. Those in his path are better off for it. See what great things the wisdom of God produces. We also see in verse 17 that true wisdom is without partiality. Now, we saw this back a couple of weeks ago in chapter 2, where it said, but if you have respect of persons, you commit sin. Did you know that the wise man is the one that's not partial? It is very wise not to make judgments based on externals. The wise man considers the heart of the man and not the clothing of the man. But worldly men consider the size of the ring that's on the man's finger. We'll notice in verse 17 also that true wisdom is without hypocrisy. That is, the wise man does not put on airs. He does not try to seem to be religious. He does not say one thing and behave another way. He does not say he is a Christian and then engage in worldly behavior. But the wise man is sincere and open, and you can count on him in every circumstance. Lastly, in verse 18, I've put it this way. The wise man is a great farmer. You'll notice that the man in verse 18 is sowing, isn't he? He's sowing, and what is he sowing? He's sowing peace. Everywhere he goes, he sows peace. He sows peace. He plants peace everywhere he goes. The idea in verse 18 is that the wise man, who is a man of peace, will sow peace in his field, and there will be a very great harvest of peace in the end. Peace will be in his life. Peace will surround him, and those around him will be partakers of that peace. You see, we reap what we sow, don't we? And the wise man who sows peace in his life will certainly reap a great harvest of peace. Would you bow with me, please? Our Heavenly Father, we come to you now. We pray, Lord, that you would make this text meaningful to us, cause us to understand it and to watch out for it, to look for it, to want it, and to desire it. Help us to ask for it. We do realize that wisdom comes from you, and if we would only ask, you would give it. And so help us to ask for it, and then help us to demonstrate the fruits of wisdom. We thank you for Jesus. We thank you for the great sacrifice that he has made for us. We thank you for the great difference that he has made in our lives, and we pray this in his name.